Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter titled this program Mixed Bag, and I don't like that at all.
I think we're
going to call it something like various.
Various, okay.
Various and variety.
It's a various mixed bag.
Well, I mean, we're starting off with a really good chef named Jamie Bissonette. And he's going to be talking to us about his
glorious charcuterie and how you can make it for yourself.
Right. Chef Jamie Bissonette, you're interesting. You're a natural for charcuterie, and so it's not surprising that you wrote the new charcuterie cookbook, and it's getting such acclaim. And also, you've won every award around, James Beard Awards, and was it Bon Appetit? What was the most popular chef?
Was the Food and Wine.
Food and Wine, most popular chef. Oh, the best new chef. You also have really two hot restaurants in Boston, as well as probably the hottest new spot called Toro in New York City. It's great, and we missed you when you were cooking in Pittsburgh. What a shame. But you said you're coming back, so that's good.
I have to come back. I loved it up there.
Yeah. So, anyhow, talk to us, because we get lots and lots of charcuterie books. And, I mean, I know yours is different, but I want you to tell our listeners how some of the ways it's different.
Well, I think that one of the major differences, I think, with this charcuterie book to others is that I took a lot of influence from my travels and different spices and things that I've had all over the world. And I wanted to put it in an approachable way, like thinking like a home cook could follow most of the recipes. Like my father, he's not a cook. He's a home cook, and he always asks for recipes to make around the holidays for pâté or for his friends. And I wanted to put a book together that non-chef could follow recipes and have good success out of.
The recipes are very creative. You're not held to any rigorous boundaries, are you?
No way. I think rules are made to be broken and boundaries are made to be pushed.
Well, there are so many creative things here, starting with the lemongrass and green curry sausage. Now that looks yummy, yummy.
It's one of my favorites. I took the influence from a street sausage that I had in Ho Chi Minh City a couple of years ago, and I've been trying to replicate it ever since.
Well, of course, I love lemongrass in just about anything. You have one recipe here. I want to make it, so I wanted to check with you. It's that your brined turkey breast. Yeah, now where is that? You make this little spice packet, and you make this brine, and then you get the turkey breast, and you put it into, you seem to love to work with pig's head. You know, that's something I can't quite bring myself to do.
I do. I love the versatility of it. Just so much fat and intramuscular tissue, and it ends up just kind of absorbing and providing so much flavor.
Well, I mean, when we were in Australia, I was supposed to roast a pig head, and the meat guy, the butcher, put it right on the counter so that it was at eye level with me, and one eye was blue and the other one was brown, and I backed off. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, but then you went on to the worst color combination recipe of all time.
Oh, don't tell that story.
She bought pig's feet, which was fine, but then she made it with spinach noodles and the red sauce, which was not fine. The pig's head would have been better.
Did it taste good?
No, not especially.
I thought it was. I was raised on pig's feet, but they were always done with a spaghetti sauce, red sauce.
It didn't look very good, Jamie. Shall we put it that way?
Yeah, but I love pig's feet.
That's when you turn the lights down, light a candle, pour a half a bottle of wine into a goblet, drink that, and then enjoy the rest of your meal.
Now, I love all these photographs of you. Your hands look as though they're just so at home handling all this charcuterie and making sausages and touching the meat and the heads. And I mean, everything seems so natural, like it's just, it's like, you were born to do this.
Sometimes I feel like that's accurate.
Holding up a piece of, is it bacon? And you can see the fat through it. It's just wonderful. I like your duck prosciutto. Tell us about your duck prosciutto.
Well, I found over the years that making a simple cured ham with just duck breasts always yielded something really delicious. And if you source out really good thick duck breasts from foie gras ducks, it's got a lot of forgiveness to it, but it also just absorbs so much flavor, stays so delectably moist. And I just love making that.
Now, I don't know. I mean, you have a recipe for Butarga. I'm probably the only food expert type who loves Italian food as well as the next person and Spanish. I cannot stand Butarga. Why?
I don't know. I mean, I love the funky, salty, like, sourness of it.
Well, I thought maybe if I made your recipe, I would like it because it seems so fresh. Where do you get roe?
You can get it from a lot of different fishmongers. There's different fish markets.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was unusual you served it with a 45 record.
Well, we were shooting the cookbook at the restaurants, and we ran out of time on one day. So the following day we were going to shoot, but it was Sunday. And Sunday brunch is one of the busiest days at our restaurants. So the photographer, Ken Goodman, is a very good friend of mine. And I said, Ken, if you want to just come to my home, I've got a pretty big kitchen and plenty of plateware, and we can plate the rest of the stuff in my apartment. And he said, yeah, absolutely. So they came to the house, and we started shooting. And as we, you know, got towards the halfway through the day, and I've known Ken for 15 years, we were joking and listening to records and talking about food. And I was like, I'm tired of all the plates. I'm tired of all the things we're planning on. He's like, yeah, what else do we have? And we started looking at artwork and things that I collected, and I was putting that record on to listen to it, and I just said, well, it's green, it's cool, why don't we plate Butarga on the record and see what happens? We took the photo, and it worked.
Now, how did the record come out?
Well, that record's been out for a long time. It's always been a classic, classic record for me, and luckily, no records were harmed in the shooting of that record.
Oh, okay. Now, what was the song?
I think on that record, I don't know what song we listened to, actually.
Oh, wow.
But we listened to pretty much the whole. Yeah, Murphy's has a great, like, punk hardcore band from Queens, New York.
Yeah, I like some of your comments here. It's American country ham, do not try this at home. I don't know why is that.
Well, a lot of people who, you know, there's a lot of cookbooks out there, a lot of charcuterie books out there that teach a lot of people how to cook and cure meats. And one of the things that people need to remember is that it's pretty dangerous. Some of the things that we do in charcuterie have been getting done for thousands of years, but it doesn't make it any less risky of getting somebody ill, sick, or having the food rot. And I think of all of the things in the book, that's the one recipe that is the most difficult to control. And I say don't try this at home more as a joke. Some of the recipes in this book aren't for first-timers. If you've never cured a ham, don't start by just curing a ham. You know, do your research, figuring out there's so many variables to put into it. But I also wanted to put the way that I make a country ham into the book. So I say don't try this at home as a precautionary tale, that you might not have success. You might end up with a ham that's a little bit too funky. You might end up with a ham that doesn't make it. You might end up with something that's delicious.
Now, another revelation to me was your grilled pig's tails. Now, I've had Fergus Henderson's grilled, roasted pig's tails, and they were nothing. I mean, they really, there was no meat. They were dry. And you explain that actually the muscle structure goes up the pig's back about 3 or 4 inches. Now, that to me is a whole different dish.
Well, we take the part of the tail that extends out, and we also take the part that turns up into the vertebrae, and we salt it and cure it and confit it, and then we either wood oven roast them at the restaurants or grill them, depending upon which restaurant we're doing them at. And you end up with a lot more meat on them than others. Some people, when they serve pigtails, they only use the long, winding part
at
the end.
That's what Fergus did.
Yeah, well, I serve that too. That's delicious. There's a good amount of fat on it.
You just sort of chew on the bone, right?
I agree. There's not a lot. So we take the top part of the pig's tail and we go up about 3 inches to where the tail ends.
You have certainly more than your share of sense of humor in this book. I'm looking at this photograph of you under the recipe for Coppa di Testa. which is pig's head, of course, and you hold up the pig's head in front of your face. It's really comical.
It's like a mask. I was trying to channel my inner Thanksgiving. I mean, not Thanksgiving, Halloween.
Halloween, right. Now, you do a lot with rabbits. Did you see the article about the giant rabbits that they're raising in Spain?
I have not.
Well, I mean, they're huge. I wish I had saved that so I could send a photograph to you. They're absolutely giant, and the breed was at other places in Europe as well. And it was a primary meat source because they were so big.
And they must have been. They were probably slow too.
And they were. It was probably heavy, but at any rate, they went. I don't know. I guess they practically went extinct, and now they're back breeding them. And they had a grown man holding one up, and it extended from like his chin to his knees.
Whoa!
Wouldn't that be something?
That would make a pretty. That would make a pretty awesome rabbit steak.
Oh, what? Where was it? You said something about when you're not sure, serve it on a taco. I thought that was very funny.
Yeah, you can make, if you grind and cook anything, you can make it into a taco. There are plenty of fast food companies that make millions of dollars off that idea.
Yeah, I know. And then I love your chapter on hoof and snout mafia. Why did you name it the mafia?
There's kind of like there was a running joke between a bunch of chef friends and I that we were all cooking a lot of nose to tail things and charcuterie, and somebody wrote, there was an article in the New Yorker a couple of years ago that referred to a bunch of us as the Hoof and Snout Mafia.
Oh, okay.
And one of my best friends in Boston, Matt, him and I got Hoof and Snout Mafia tattoos.
Now, when you're talking about pig's feet, you're talking about 1-pounders. I don't think I've ever had a pig's foot that weighed a pound. Where do you get those?
We pull them off the animals that we get. We get in whole animals. You know, sometimes they're a little bit lighter. Sometimes they're a little bit heavier. A lot of we get our pigs from Brambley Farm. And they've got 2 farms, one in New York and one in Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And they're Tamworth pigs. They go high enough up, they can be about a pound. Some of the red wattles that I get from other mm-hmm. farmers are a little bit more than a pound. So it depends.
You also like tripe. And you named one Tripe a la Collinsville, which is your hometown, is it?
Yeah, so I was looking at a lot of, like, the history of a lot of foods, and, you know, tripe a la con or tripe a la mode, and then you've got, you know, like, beef bourguignon. There are a lot of things named after the region they were from, and I was making this tripe dish for years. And people are like, well, what do you call it? And if I was at an Italian restaurant, I could call it tripa. If I was at a Spanish restaurant, I could call it callos. If I wanted to put it in English, I really didn't have a good way of describing it for the title, just putting tripe. And I figured that if I put tripe a la Bissonette or tripe a la Jamie, I don't know, my own name seemed a little bit not my style. So I put one day tripe a la Collinsville, kind of as a joke, and the entire staff thought it was amazing. So we kept it.
Oh, funny. That's good. Now, your love of pig's head explains why one of your Boston restaurants is named Copa, right? Yep.
Absolutely. Yep. I love the pig's head, and I love that nape of meat right behind it.
Nice. And I think the prettiest thing in your whole book is the pig ear tureen. How do you get the contrast in color? Do you buy different colored pigs?
No, those are all the same. They're all one color. The striation is the fat and the skin on the ear because it's cooked with so much soy that turns black. And then the cartilage on the inside doesn't really absorb any of the color but absorbs the flavor, so that stays white.
Oh, I see.
And then we use a little bit of that gelée from the braising of the pig's ear, so you get the all those different textures.
Well, can you guarantee if I do this sweetbread saltimbocca that I'm going to get something edible? People have given me wonderful sweetbreads, and I ruin them. They come out like rocks. What am I doing wrong?
Probably overcooking them. I think that if you just cook them ever so gently and air on the side of, you know, just getting cooking them till they're just set, not blubbery, and then cooking them the second time so they're hot and they're ready.
Well, you conclude the book with a bunch of sides and condiments that are interesting and delicious in their own right. And I think that anybody will find a part of the animal in here that's interesting to make. I know we're going to go after the smoked tongue recipes. And also, I think that we're going to try to make a little Romesco sauce. And you have a lot of good kidney recipes, Texas barbecue kidneys. This is a fascinating cookbook. We love it, Jamie.
Oh, thank you very much. I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun writing it.
I'm going to have to hide this lardo recipe from my husband, or he's going to end up with the same kind of cholesterol issues you were talking about.
Oh,
he loves it.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
The other one who had lardo 2 days in a row when we were in Lucca. I couldn't believe it. She said, I don't like this. And then she ate the whole thing. I was hoping to get some of hers, but she ate all of hers and then came back the next day to the same restaurant to have lardo all over again.
Well, Jamie, congratulations on the book, a wonderful career. And please extend congratulations also to your photographer because he did a wonderful job. And I think I might even try out some of these.
If you do, let me know how they turn out.
We'll see you back in our hometown when you come.
Absolutely. I can't wait to come back.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and with a slight shift in direction here, and we're going to be going to Keith Schroeder, who is a first-class chef and culinary instructor as well as food writer, and he's going to get us all on the right track with his book, Cooking Light's Mad Delicious Cookbook. Keith Schroeder, you brought out the big guns when you got Alton Brown to write the introduction to your book. The book is called Mad Delicious, The Science of Making Healthy Food Taste Amazing, and it's a cooking light book. He says, Alton Brown, this is everything I love in a cookbook, fun, readable, and fully functional. It constantly answers my favorite question, why? Tell us about the concept for this book, Keith.
Sure. Well, the things that I wanted to do was demystify cooking technique for the home cook and then certainly make sure that people were taking care of themselves and eating well. And so what we wanted to do was start with cuisines that were inherently healthy, quite bold in flavor. Typically in culinary education, you see things start from a very, what we refer to as Francocentric, right? So France is the center of the culinary universe in the Western world, and I really wanted to strip away from that and really focus more in on technique and bold ingredients and, of course, explaining why every last ingredient was in every recipe, and all of those steps in the recipes really make an effort to address what I refer to as the between the lines or between the steps, everything that needs to be paid attention to in a recipe. So rather than just saying, do this, then do this, then do this, we're saying, well, regulate your heat. And the reason you're regulating your heat is because you don't want to scorch the scallop. And if you don't, here's what might happen. And so we anticipate a lot of the slip-ups that the home cook might encounter in their busy day.
Keith, you're writing this for the home cook. Is there any particular kind of home cook? Because that would be a category all over the globe.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there are really two audiences. Number one, I really wanted this book to appeal to the person who was terrified to be adventurous in the kitchen. So this is the book for the person who tends to follow every recipe to the letter, and I'm making attempts to set them free. And, you know, one of the things I talked about, the editor who brought me on to write this book, is I really want to set the home cook free from the recipe to teach them the whys of cooking so that they can learn how to improvise in the kitchen. And so I think that's an ideal audience for Mad Delicious.
Now, you are a teacher at heart. you said.
Yes, at heart, yeah. My day job, I own an ice cream company.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your ice cream company. Why don't you get that in while we have it? You have a website, and you know, where is it? You're in Atlanta?
Yeah, we're based in Atlanta, Georgia. We're growing all over the globe right now. A small factory in Bangkok, Thailand. I'm starting to do quite a bit of business in Las Vegas, but more about my ice cream company can be found at highroadcraft.com.
Right. You know, isn't there a famous bakery in Atlanta, too, that's getting a lot of attention? We interviewed some recently.
There's a guy who makes donuts.
Oh, donuts. The donut guy.
Sublime Donuts. Kamal. Very good guy.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
He's getting a lot of action on his donuts internationally, too. I mean, that's
interesting. Yep, he's a fun guy. Good friend of ours. He serves our ice cream.
Perhaps that's why he has a bakery in Thailand, I think. We have
a lot in common.
There you go. Seems like there must be something simpatico about the fact that you're both doing something in Thailand.
Yeah.
It's not exactly around the corner from Atlanta.
No.
No, I was really curious about, I mean, I get the concept. You explain the concept very thoroughly in your book, and you are very articulate about it now. But, I mean, like, how did you figure out what the areas were that you really had to explain? Probably a standard set of things that home cooks generally are afraid of or get wrong.
Yes, and I really learned that in two areas of my life. Number one, again, I used to teach at New England Culinary Institute in Burlington, Vermont, and the experience level of the cooks in my classes was all over the board. And so I was used to helping the inexperienced, and then throughout my career have had plenty of opportunities to teach classes to the home cook at houseware stores, at culinary schools, at hotels and resorts, and then certainly in people's homes, right? As the chef, you always get pulled into the kitchen to fix things, whether it's Thanksgiving or a weekend barbecue. You try to hide under the radar, but it never works. You're always carving the turkey or temping the steaks out on the grill.
Well, I'm looking at a recipe. I just randomly opened the cookbook, and sure. I opened it to red curry boiled peanuts, okay? You have lesson. You can boil a peanut, too. Then you have the timing, hands-on, total. Then you have a little, I don't know, it's like a little encouraging, what would you call that, your little speech?
Warm, soft peanuts? The head note in the recipe.
Yeah. And what is that? That's supposed to motivate?
Right. It's supposed to get you, well, help you decide whether or not you're going to make that recipe or go ahead and turn the page to something you might be more interested in making.
Oh, okay. So, and then we have the actual recipe. And you have like a little chart. The first one is food, then how much, and then why. So we see food, water, how much, 1 quart or enough to cover peanuts, why, you're going to boil the heck out of the peanuts, you need plenty of water. And I mean, I opened this totally at random. I didn't fish it out. And you proceed along through all the ingredients like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you have followed these steps, and you break it down into every single thing that anybody would want to know about the steps, procedures.
That's right. I wanted this to be a book that, A, would make people chuckle as we go through things. I mean, certainly the word science is on the cover of the book, but I did not want to make it intimidating. This is the applied science of cooking, and, you know, cooking, A, is supposed to be fun, and I'm really just trying to help people understand, and having witnessed people make tons and tons and tons of mistakes or be afraid or just flat out uncomfortable in their home kitchen to experiment, wanted to make sure that each recipe really, really worked, and not only did the recipe work well, but that the person felt who
tried the recipe felt like they could create variations on that recipe because of what they learned in preparing it.
Well, that's very noble, I think. I think that's a great vision in this cookbook.
Put me out of the cookbook writing business.
So, no, I mean, what are you didn't just stick with ordinary recipes like red curry, boiled peanuts. Is not your typical starter cookbook recipe, is it?
No, not at all. But, you know, if you take a look at my intentions were, obviously to teach people how to cook, but delights me about cooking is learning about people and culture. And I was given carte blanche by the editors at Cooking Life to really go as broad as I wanted to around the globe. And so for me, it was a tremendous amount of fun. And so I live here in the South, and boiled peanuts are a pretty common thing, but there was no way in heck that a standard Southern-style boiled peanut was going to meet the sodium guidelines for cooking life. So it's one of those things where you meditate on it a little bit and think, hey, well, a Southern boiled peanut can be downright too salty.
Can't they?
Right? How can we get a bunch of flavor in there and make them delightful? And the red curry was a ton of fun.
So basically, the healthfulness in these recipes is as important a part of your mission as the clarity of the directions, right?
Yes, and I wanted this to be the cookbook that the healthfulness of it was an afterthought. You know, in the eyes of the person eating the food, I don't want folks to dig into any of those recipes and say, wow, these are clearly tended to be lower in fat or lower in calories. We did not evoke that response when we tested the recipes. It was simply, oh, these are really bold. They're delicious. You know, we used cream. We used butter. We just used them very, very sensibly. And where you might go heavy on fat and salt, we just went a lot heavier on things like chilies and herbs and citrus and vinegars. And bold flavor existed with the right amount of fat and sodium so that you had that satisfaction that you've eaten.
Well, I mean, you're a pretty witty guy, I must say. I mean, here's this one I'm looking at now. Says comfort with monochrome. Now, that's kind of off the charts, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm an eccentric fellow for sure. I mean, and keep in mind that, you know, because I work full time. When you're writing in a closet at 3 o'clock in the morning, you get pretty silly.
So that's why you're calling this Mad, this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they actually named it for me. They said you're like the madman.
So you're a native, are you?
Oh no, I'm not native. I'm actually native to the South Shore of Long Island, New York.
Well, you lost that accent, thank heavens, right?
Yeah.
So what kind of response are you getting to this book?
It's been overwhelmingly positive, you know, from folks who've not really been active home cooks to people who are real serious professionals. Everybody seems to be enjoying some aspect of it. I think I'm getting a lot of respect from my fellow professionals because they feel like the book really holds people's hands and nurtures them through the process of cooking. And then, you know, an interesting group, this book is really resonating with men, actually, which is not your common audience for
a home. Actually, it is. It's getting, we laugh about it in the summer around the pool. All the guys are talking about cooking.
All right. Well, that's good. That's good news.
Yeah. So, anyhow, it just seems to fit a funny niche, the whole thing. I mean, you said this whole book, it all started at a food blogger conference. The funny thing, though, I wasn't a blogger or a writer, so I thought. You see, I own an ice cream company. It was drumming up support for our emerging brand, and I thought getting to know bloggers would be a good thing. So you're at least honest, too.
Yeah, I kind of tell it like it is, you know. I can thank my mother for that.
What's unique about your ice cream?
Oh boy, everything under the sun, really. We do it in a way that's really old world. We vat pasteurize all of the products. We bring in raw milk from a farm in South Georgia. We, all of the inclusions and just every last bit of the ice cream is made here by chefs. And the other thing is that we are really marketed toward food enthusiasts and professionals. So we're not everybody's ice cream, but if you're...
What kind of flavors do you do?
So one of our biggest selling flavors is bourbon burnt sugar. So it's got this creme brulee profile with the shot of bourbon. That's a great one.
Oh, it has booze in it? That must be the hot new thing, because I just got a shipment of something called booze something. It's booze... Bows or something like that, which is ice cream with whiskey in it.
Oh, fun.
So is that a new trend, I guess? It's not even new.
I think pastry chefs have been doing it for quite some time, and now it's becoming more of a common thing to see it on the retail shelves.
Yeah, Humphrey Slocum in San Francisco has a breakfast ice cream that's loaded with booze.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, Keith, I can't pass by this little blurb in the back cover. Keith Schroeder, it's under called Meet Your Teacher. Keith Schroeder is a mad scientist in the kitchen, a goofball at the dinner table, and some say the best culinary teacher ever. He's also the founder of High Road Craft Ice Cream and Sorbet in Atlanta, Georgia. And I guess that probably sums up pretty much what this is all about and what you're going to get with this book. That's great.
Thank you.
Keith, thank you for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good luck with your book.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, another change up from the Cooking Light book. Here's a group of people, this trio had a ball crossing the country sampling all the goodies from food trucks, and they wrote a book about it. So let's welcome Kim, Philip, and Terry to talk about the food truck road trip. I'm hungry just looking at this book. It's called Food Truck Road Trip, A Cook. And we have on the line Kim Pham, Philip Shen, and Terry Phillips, all of you. And you're all on the West Coast, so you're probably not as hungry as I am. But you did this book. Did you say 2.5 weeks to do the tastings?
Yes.
How did you do that?
Yeah, we definitely really wanted to... be authentic in this cookbook in the sense that there are a lot of food truck books out there currently, and they're focused a lot on kind of adapted recipes, you know, from food trucks people have tried. And we really wanted to get the authentic recipes from the actual food trucks themselves. So in the big picture, it meant that we had to go out to visit each of these trucks to take pictures of them making the dishes and get their actual recipes. So in order to do that the most efficient way, we had to kind of get out there in 2.5 weeks, just so that our road trip costs weren't ballooning up to a crazy number.
Yeah, but you gained weight, you said.
Oh.
I mean, you don't look fat in pictures. Now, you started out, let's say, Kim and Philip started out as photographers and then launched this blog, which is BehindTheFoodCarts.com, and then I guess even before that you picked up Terry Phillips, who is a professional writer. And then how did you plot this whole thing?
We basically wanted to start creating recipes on our blog, and then we've been focused mostly on the West Coast, so we've been doing, you know, stories about Portland. Now Kim and I are based in San Francisco, and then LA, since that's our hometown. So we've been kind of doing stories along the West Coast, and we thought it would be interesting to really see how the food truck scene is across the whole country, because it varies from locality to locality. So we really wanted to do something a little bit ambitious in our minds, and is to, kind of see how each of the cities, what they're offering, and get those recipes.
Now, was it hard getting the recipes out of these people?
Actually, no, it wasn't. Everyone was really forthcoming and just really excited to be a part of our book. And so we were really surprised and just really happy that everyone was so willing to share with us.
Well, I think anybody reading this book will be struck by the diversity involved here. You have just about...
I think that's kind of what we're aiming for. I think it really represents what the food truck culture kind of embodies in America, is that diversity, right? You get a chance to really try foods that you've never tried. I think there's definitely different factions of trucks out there, and one of them is kind of newer food, these tacos that you've never had before. But we're also seeing a lot of different cities that are, for example, if they're missing sort of a cultural food, food trucks are really filling in that niche or that gap that city doesn't have. For example, in Portland, a very famous Thai food cart called Nam Kamangai, she's kind of really introducing people there to this kind of chicken over rice dish that she specializes in, and she just does this one dish, and it's amazing, you know. So I think we're also seeing a lot of that, too, in the food truck scene.
Yeah, well, a lot of it depends on the local regulations, because I know some people, we live in Pittsburgh, and a number of the truck people were really, they had difficulty getting all the permits and licenses and so forth.
Yeah, we were in Greenville, South Carolina, last year for a food festival, and one of the events, the food was all provided by all the food trucks in Greenville, but there are only four.
Not a big meal.
and their output was a bit slow.
Yeah. So, of course, the real point of this whole book and of your road trip and of your blog is that you found that what connects all these food truck operators is one thing called passion. And you really were not just getting the recipes, but you were getting their stories, the stories behind these people. They must have been an interesting lot.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just such a, kind of as we talked about the broad range of food that you're encountering in the book, it's similarly, there's a broad range of kind of people that end up in the food truck scene. You know, we've had stories of one of our favorites is Bella Torte in New York. They are an Italian kind of pastry truck, and the owner, Joe, he actually was a plumber not too long ago, and when the economy wasn't doing well, he decided to go to pastry school, and then now he runs this amazing truck serving cannolis and different inventions from his mind, and it's just kind of a fun story that you kind of see. But we're also seeing on the flip side, in San Francisco Bay Area, there's a lot of chefs that worked at Michelin star restaurants, and now they want to kind of branch out on their own, and the food truck scene is giving them an opportunity to share their style of food, Matt.
And now I asked, before we went on the air, I asked him what her favorite food city was, and I thought your answer was interesting. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, sure. I said Raleigh, North Carolina had a fantastic food truck scene out there. It's one of my favorite cities because everyone there is very supportive of each other. All the food trucks are very helpful, and they make really good food, too. It's like all this really fantastic, delicious food that's coming off of these trucks. And it's an up-and-coming city, so there's a lot of different ones, and it's a very family-friendly city, and so it's just very vibrant, and there's lots of great food, and there's lots of great people out there.
The food truck scene is a little bit different city to city, isn't it? I mean, I see two different combinations, perhaps only two, and perhaps you can point out there are some more. For example, Portland, Oregon seems to specialize in having the food trucks in pods, so there's a group of 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 all together, so that the patrons can go to one spot and they may not decide what they're going to order until they see how long the line is or what they're in the mood for today. And then there are other cities, and perhaps L.A. is one of the better examples of this, is that food truck, if you want to know where your food truck is today, you're gonna have to find out either via the Internet or via cell phone where they're going to be today, because they won't always be in the same place. And there might only be one of them right there.
Yes, it was fascinating, not just the diversity of the style of food and the people, but also the way the cities handle the food trucks. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, Portland has the food pods where they're pretty much stationary every day, and you know where they're going to be. And also the city's attitude towards food trucks. Like Kim mentioned, North Carolina, the city themselves are actually very supportive of the food trucks. they actually had all met with us in the parking lot of the health department. The health department kind of offered up a space for us to do this.
Wow.
And then on the flip side, there's like New York City, where they have to go through these crazy hoops just to get the permits to serve food. There's lots of, like, there's black market permits. They have to deal with parking tickets as just a basic overhead that they have to handle each day. So it was a really interesting look in just the way each city handles food trucks.
Question a little off the I didn't know that one of the most popular foods in Japan was curry, which you say.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually spent a little bit of post-college in Japan, and kind of one of the comfort foods out there is called Japanese curry, but it's really like a Japanese version of, you know, Indian curry, which would kind of mix their own spices in. But if you go to any Japanese supermarket, you can just buy blocks of curry and kind of make it at home. It's basically a roux that you can just mix with whatever ingredients you want with a little bit of water, and you'll have a delicious meal. And it's actually really, flavors are just very familiar, I think, even for American audiences. And it's, and that dish that we have in the book from Japa Curry and San Francisco, it also includes, like, Japanese fried chicken. So it's just a very, I think, comforting dish for from a Japanese perspective, but also just from an American perspective, because it's fried chicken and kind of this kind of roux-based stew almost.
How is this different, this trend, from food trucks that have been around for years and years and years, with soft pretzels or roasted chestnuts or hot dogs?
I think the biggest difference is kind of the term that we're kind of used to hearing nowadays, which is gourmet food truck, right? I think that's the big kind of buzzword that's been thrown around lately. It's the biggest difference is the food truck nowadays really are focused more on higher end cuisine and not necessarily the food from the past, like, you know, hot dogs and different, you know, sandwiches with chips and soda. You think a lot of these trucks we found out are much more involved in their kind of almost like farm to table in a sense than most, you know, restaurants we go to actually. There's some examples in our book where those trucks that literally make everything in their recipes and dishes from scratch, you know, there's ketchup from scratch, there's ranch sauce from scratch, you know, they brine their chickens for, you know, days, or they smoke, you know, themselves. So I think we're seeing a lot more of that kind of chef-driven kind of gourmet-style food trucks right now.
As a general rule, the food trucks that you made, I mean, you had a set of 63 of them, which is quite a lot, although it's not a complete universe. Do they tend to specialize in just one dish? Or do they have a menu that extends beyond that into several different specialties?
We're definitely seeing, I think, a good combination of both of those. I think versus even a restaurant, I think even the ones that do diversify their menus, it's still a much smaller selection than an average restaurant where you'll see like 30 items. I think they still have to limit their menus, which I think ends up making the food a little bit more focused, right? You definitely know they're kind of put out stuff that's passionate, like we use that word, or soulful, that means something to them because they don't have as much resources to put out big menus. So, but we do definitely see some that just specialize in one particular cuisine or maybe like a fusion cuisine. But we personally have really fallen in love with some trucks lately that just do possibly just one dish really well, because it's like that's their thing. You know, you know what to order, you know what to expect, and you're just getting kind of the best representation of what their cooking is and who they are.
Here's a question you probably were not even expecting even the slightest possibility of, but do these people make a good living? It seems like awfully hard work and doing the same thing every day. What's it like from an economic standpoint? I mean, is it a career that you would advance for your son or daughter instead of going to college? Or is it simply something people do because it's the only skill set they have? What is it that sets food truckers apart? Are they prospering?
I think the opportunity is really there. Like, to kind of start answering that question, I think the food truck culture really let some of these chefs that possibly couldn't afford to open a real restaurant to be able to get their food out there. And I think from an economic standpoint, like you said, it's definitely tough hours. I think Terry writes about kind of how, you know, you're stuck in a box literally for 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you really have to love what you're doing. And I think for a lot of people, it's a stepping stone, and it's really exciting for us to see. One of the things we always say is it's really exciting for us to see what trucks do after they've opened up their first truck.
Yeah,
you know, we've seen trucks open up multiple trucks, or they possibly might go brick and mortar. So I think that's kind of where that, from the economic standpoint, they can actually grow. It's a great stepping stone for expanding your brand and your business to multiple brick and mortars potentially too.
Yeah, I have one more question for those who are going to be getting this book, Food Truck Road Trip, a cookbook. Did you test all these recipes?
Yeah, we got a lot of recipes in from a lot of different food trucks, and I think the hardest part was figuring out how does it fit into a compilation. And we tested and people sent back, but we also had a great team of recipe testers, as we called them. We had friends and family actually help us test all these recipes, because there's just no way the three of us could have gone through everything by ourselves in that short amount of time. So we really thanked our team for helping us out on that.
Well, I think that you probably will do very well on this book, and you certainly have enough material left over for the next one. And I guess probably enthusiasm for doing this tour again.
And one thing we should mention before we leave, because it's hard to figure out how to put things in sequence in a book like this. So indexing it was a real challenge, except that you did one great thing at the end, which is geographically all the food trucks in Los Angeles are in one place, all the food trucks in Poland are in one place, listed by city. So if you have a passion to do your own subset of the journey that Phil and Terry and co made, you can pick your geography across the United States and know where to go and perhaps even plan your menu way in advance. And we thank you so much for sharing your adventures with us and for sharing the information you gathered with an audience which I'm sure is going to be very, very pleased to get something more than just a listing of food trucks and where they are.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, gang, that was done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Awesome. We're so excited. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, if you think that's a strange and adventurous trip, wait till you hear about the trip after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We encounter a number of very interesting projects, and I would say that this one kind of moves up to the top of the most interesting ones. It's a project called The Bread Exchange, Tales and Recipes from a Journey of Baking and Bartering. And the author, who we are going to be talking to now, is Malin Elmlid. Malin is traveling the world bartering bread. Could you take us to the beginning of this project, Malin, and explain it to our listeners?
Yes, thank you for having me. It started off about 2007, just because I was very frustrated with the bread in Berlin, where I was living. And I started to bake bread on my own. And when I say bread, it was a white sourdough bread, completely without yeast. So very simple. And it's not always easy, so I was practicing quite a lot, and I manically was baking every day, and I had so much bread that I started giving away. And after about a year, things started to come back to me as, simply return gifts for a bread I had already given away. And that's how it started. I realized that I was standing in the middle of some kind of trading network, my bread for anything that can inspire me, because I never ask for anything in return. And that's how the bread exchange started. But that was 2008, so it was quite a long time ago, 1,400 loaves ago.
Now, you make the same bread, the basic sourdough bread, all the time.
Yeah, the basic is the same, but the project has developed to something way larger. It's, for me, it's not anymore only about the bread, it's more about the people that I'm meeting. And every time I'm giving someone a bread, they always tell me a story, or there is something they want to share with me. Sometimes it's ingredients, sometimes it's family recipes or knowledge around food that I didn't have before. And I often use this in my bread again. So the canvas is simple white sourdough bread, and then I paint it with whatever people bring to me. So it can be black charcoal, making a black
sourdough bread.
Oh, is that what that picture
is? Which tastes like a white one.
There's a picture of that. I wondered if you burnt it.
It's charcoal. You would think you can't eat that, but it's very healthy. They use
really?
It in Japan for detox. Yeah.
Uh-huh. How do you connect with the people you're gifting your bread to?
I write about it on my blog, The Bread Exchange. I simply write when I have something to offer or, yeah, on the other social media networks like Facebook or Instagram. And then I take whoever comes first with an offer. So it's not like picking out the raisins. It's really first come, first serve, which is really important because it makes it that you don't, I don't know, it's not about getting the best thing or whatever. It's rather more about meeting people that you didn't necessarily expect to meet, which is very important for me.
Well, do they contact you?
Yeah, exactly. So I post, say, I have a bread. It's made with this flour. It's made with this kind of a salt. And maybe it's a story that goes with it from some further ingredients that I've used. And then I go up and use sage leaves and then people answer and say, hey, I have this or that, or, and then we make up a time where we meet, and that's how it is. And it can be anywhere in the world because I travel quite a lot with this, and yeah, I could meet and prayed, maybe teach me how to make a proper coconut bread because I'd like to learn that.
Now, tell me how you pay for your trips. You travel almost all the time.
Yeah, in the beginning, I was working for a fashion company, and I studied business, so I had a pretty good position in the fashion industry, and I was able to do this on the side, or rather, this was kind of a way for me to stay grounded, somewhat superficial business. And so then it wasn't really on my expenses I was traveling. This was my time off. But then now, like, since I got a book deal to write a story about it, and I decided to take 2 years off and travel the world and write this story. And so then it's my savings and, yeah, a bit of a prepayment, but it's mainly my savings. This has been a decision for me to do.
Wow.
And invest in. Yeah. But it's the biggest thing I've done. This has been great to meet and learn to know more, yeah, very wide variety of people.
What's up?
It would be sad not to write it down. Someone else, maybe.
Tell me
Sorry.
Some of the more interesting places that you've been and the barters that you've executed.
It's hard to say what is the better, but I mean, when I made this book, I picked out a few stories, 12 stories, travel stories from this journey. And one of them is obviously Afghanistan. That was pretty incredible to get to go there. And it showed to me the power of bread as a door opener. I was able to interact with the local women. And that's pretty hard as a Western woman, obviously. That was a very big story, but also, I mean, it's been also New York, the encounters that I met there. You would not expect people to open up so easy in New York just as well as in Afghanistan. I found that quite unexpected. And Switzerland, I've had some very interesting trades. One time I got a call from a Swiss chef, and he wanted to trade bread with me and offered me a dinner and a trip down to Switzerland. So I went on this trip. I did not know what to expect. And then when I got there, I was invited to 22-course dinner at the Foundation Beiler, a large art foundation who is also making the Art Basel in Miami. And that was quite unexpected. And I think it kind of shows the wideness of where bread can take you and the understanding of bread. That it's understood in just as well as in very wealthy art cliques, so to say, as well as among some of the poorest people in the world, and regardless of religion or culture background. I find that very interesting. And men and women, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, I think it probably helps that you are extremely attractive.
I think it's more about being just very open and curious and friendly and, yeah,
I think that's
isn't it dangerous?
Thing.
Aren't you worried sometimes?
You have to have a very good sense for people. And I can also be very cold and short if I don't feel that someone is treating me with respect. Yeah.
you said two things that caught my attention. One is about you don't put a price. You never put a price on your bread because in a way it's sort of priceless. Because you're only making four loaves and it takes you all day. I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was interesting that you've managed to figure out how to solve the logistical problem of how to be able to bake in the first place by asking people if you can use their kitchens. And one of them just happened to be Daniel Hume of 10 Madison Park. fourth best chef in the world.
I didn't even ask him. I was asking someone else and he overheard it in the back of the line. He was standing behind me when I was food shopping and I asked the Russ and Daughters owners in Houston Street in New York.
Right.
And then he overheard it and said, "Hey, you can use my oven." So that was completely his idea. So yeah, but I guess bread has really something. I don't think I could have done this with soap or wine or marmalade, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think bread is actually the key to this, because just like for Daniel Hum being Swiss guy, I'm pretty sure that his connection to bread is very strong.
Uh-huh.
And just like a woman in Afghanistan explains to me that bread is the absolutely most important in their family, and it's even more important to her because that's the only time she gets to spend with friends is when she goes and bakes bread in the local bakery. So I don't know, I think, and for me it's also share bread. You can only share bread, you don't eat it on your own. It is really something you have to share. There's something very warm and homey about bread.
Did you ever come across the historical factoid that in the days of ancient Rome, the citizens of Rome all got a free bread ration, but it was the man of the house who went to collect it. So it was free bread for all every day for all citizens of Rome.
Bread and games.
Bread and circus, I guess. Yeah, well, this is the bread part. I thought the interesting part about it was it was the guy's job to go get it.
Yeah, it's the same in many cultures, actually.
I wanted to tell you, it's really started as an art project in Pittsburgh called Conflict Kitchen, and it's a kiosk, was a storefront, and the committee selects countries that the United States is in conflict with, and cooks food from that particular country as a way of breaking down barriers. Well, the latest one, they have done North Korea, Afghanistan, Argentina, I mean a lot of them, but the latest one is Palestinian. And they have quotes from Palestinians on wrappers that they wrap the food in. And they had protesters close them down with death threats.
What?
Yes.
Where was this?
It's in Pittsburgh. It's called Conflict Kitchen. I'm sure you can find it on the internet. But it's really a sad commentary that here's an organization which is trying to do what it can to avoid conflict, and the intelligent people out there decided it would be a good idea to send death threats to the director.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I think the police got involved, and they assured him he would be all right, so they did reopen.
But it's not not fraught with risk, what you're doing.
Be careful.
Be careful now.
Yeah.
Be careful what kind of bread you bake.
So far, it's been going well.
Okay, well, give us the address to your blog for people who want to look it up.
Yeah, so you can find my stories around my travels on thebreadexchange.com. It's my website. Do you feel like I'm missing something?
No. I think it's very good, and I think that it takes studying of all your experiences. And there are also some recipes I can point out. So lots of very attractive photographs, really lavish photographs.
Yeah, but the nice part with the photographs is that I mean, I took about 60%, but 40% has been traded with some very, very, very good photographers around the world.
Oh,
from all over the world, from Russia to the U.S. to Holland to Belgium and, Afghanistan, obviously. And it's very good people in there. That's why I had to add 8 pages thank you chapter.
Oh, yes. And and is it still ongoing, this project?
Yeah. I have a very hard time to stop doing this because there is something I have no problem with money. I mean, I studied business. For me, money definitely gives us something great, anonymity. And you don't want to be in personal contact with everyone, but there is something you definitely miss when you're only dealing with money. There's a personal connection to people, and for me in this project, I'm also meeting people completely out of my comfort zone, which I would not get in contact to if it wouldn't have been for this. And I find it, I mean, you're a journalist, so you have this all the time, but it would be really cool if more people could experience this, because it's been very, it's opening my horizons daily.
Well, it's certainly opening ours. I was really amazed at the book, and I wish you lots of luck with that and your ongoing project. Again, it's
Thank you.
The Bread Exchange, and listeners, check it out on the web. Thank you,
Thank
Marilyn.
You,
Thank
you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I have to say, that has to be one of the most interesting adventures we've ever featured on the program.
Yes.
And it still puzzles me how the young lady came up with that idea, but she certainly made quite a thing out of it. Anyway, you may be sure there'll be other interesting folks to talk to you again, same time, same place next week. So until then,
bye-bye.